Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with the music score from the classic 1968 movie The Green Beret, starring who else but John Wayne, to introduce today's show, Voices of Veterans and Volunteers. What I noticed about this musical score in comparison to the original, Barry Sandler's Ballad of the Green Berets, is the movie score keeps repeating the same motif throughout. Brave, selfless men and heroes, the best of the best, does not mention death or grieving or the young widow sitting at home waiting for her husband to return, not knowing that he has already been killed. Very few mainstream movies about war tell the real story, preferring instead to glorify the heroic aspects over the messy parts, the death and destruction on the battlefields and in civilian areas, and the anguish of those surviving the battle only to return home physically or psychologically injured, then struggling to maintain a civilian life, or coming back to live on our streets. Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki last week laid out an ambitious five-year goal of curbing the number of homeless veterans and pledging $3.2 billion to the issue that is more rapidly affecting those who served in Iraq and Afghanistan wars than by any other past conflict. Secretary Shinseki said, "No one who has served this nation as a veteran should ever be living on the streets. In the past, VA focused largely on getting homeless veterans off the street. This plan is different. It aims as much, if not more, on preventing homelessness as it does on rescuing those who live on the streets," unquote. Roughly 131,000 of the nation's 24 million veterans may be homeless on any given night, and about twice as many are homeless each year, according to Veterans Affairs estimates. While homeless Vietnam veterans first spent, on average, 5 to 10 years trying to readjust to society, Iraq and Afghanistan veterans can end up homeless within 18 months, the study said. Max Cleland, the Secretary of the American Battle Monuments Commission and a Democratic Senator from Georgia from 1997 to 2003, is also co-author of Heart of a Patriot, How I Found the Courage to Survive Vietnam, Walter Reed, and Karl Rove. In a moving op-ed in the New York Times, Max Cleland writes, "Weeks before the troubles at Walter Reed became public in 2007, my counselor put it to me simply, we are drowning in war. The problems at Walter Reed," he writes, "had nothing to do with the dedicated doctors and nurses there. The problems had to do with the White House and Congress and the Department of Defense. The problems had to do with money. When we are at war, America spends billions on missiles, tanks, attack helicopters, and such. But the wounded warriors who will never fight again tend to be put on the back burner." That's from the op-ed that Max Cleland has in the New York Times. I'm going to put a link to this op-ed. I think it's excellent, and I'm going to put a link on it at our website, raisingsandradio.org, and urge you to read it.
Back at home, a young wife waits. Her green beret has met his fate. He has died for those oppressed, leaving her this last request. Put silver wings on my son's chest. Make him one of America's best.
And that was a section of the original Barry Sandler version of the Ballad of the Green Berets. In recognition of our veterans, Raising Sand Radio brings four perspectives today. President of Vets for Peace, Mike Ferner. Kathy Marsham of Veterans of Modern Warfare, also with a community-based warrior transition program, and J.C. Smith of Nashville, Tennessee's Operation Stand Down. We'll also hear a civilian view with photographer and concerned citizen Jim Lomason. Mike Ferner is the current president of Veterans for Peace, and that organization is tightening up its internal processes to reach out in new ways to its membership. Vets for Peace has seen a spurt of new membership, and I asked if the onset of the current wars is behind this.
For veterans, as with everybody in society, when an invasion occurs and there's a shooting war going on and there are casualties being inflicted, it becomes a major topic of conversation, and it reminds veterans of why, for example, our members, reminds them why they joined Veterans for Peace. And for veterans that are not members, they've they start thinking about, oh, you know, here we go again. How can we be doing this again? And they start looking for some organization that will be supportive and where they can have a voice. And so that's, you know, why we see that happen.
Mm-hmm. And are you finding that the younger generation of warriors is joining Vets for Peace?
Well, in very small numbers right now. The young men and women coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, there are other organizations, Iraq Veterans Against the War, for example, that Veterans for Peace is very supportive of. And we find that when veterans first come back from a war, that's the kind of organization they want to belong to usually right away, is one that's focused just on the conflict they've just been through and is going to be composed of people that are more of their own age and background. But the other thing we find is that after a few years go by, for those members of those organizations that are that keep up with what it means to be working towards a peaceful society, that frequently they become members of Veterans for Peace because we're the organization that, though we've been around for 25 years next year, and we're the organization of veterans that really takes a long look at why it is we get into wars in this country and dedicated ourselves to doing what we can to break that cycle.
And Vets for Peace also mentors, in some sense, the groups like IVAW.
Yes, some of the young men and women who came back from Iraq very early on in 2004 met with some of our members who were Vietnam veterans, and over the course of a few months they decided to start their own organization, and they announced that organization at the Veterans for Peace Conference in Boston in 2004, and we've been very, as an organization, we've been very supportive of them ever since then, and provided whatever kind of assistance that we could.
We're speaking with Mike Ferner, president of Vets for Peace. Mike, how does Vets for Peace work? There are chapters all around the country, and if people want to get involved, how can they learn more?
Well, wherever you're at around the country, you can go to our website, which is Veterans for Peace, one word, veteransforpeace.org, and there's general information about the organization, plus there's also a page in there that has chapter contacts and has contact information for the places where we have chapters, and we're always looking for people who want to start a chapter if they don't have one yet.
With the news now focused on the shootings down at Fort Hood, there must be a lot of conversation going on in Vets for Peace around this kind of incident. Can you give us a general idea of how people in Vets for Peace are talking about this?
Well, you're right. It has generated a lot of conversation among our members, and the organization put out a statement on that. The discussion mostly centers around how crazy the war is and the madness of war and how violence begets violence and why we need to dedicate ourselves to stopping that. That seems to be the theme of most of the conversations, that it's a tragedy and one that we now see here in our own country reflects some of the tragedy that war is causing in a number of other places around the world. And it's all part of the same resort to violence that our government has done, and we need to create a culture of peace.
And that's a very different message to the one that is being promoted, say, in the New York Times, one of the largest newspapers in the country, which is, oh, here's a Muslim man, a Palestinian Muslim man, a Palestinian Muslim man who couldn't find a wife who'd wear a hijab, who's become progressively more religious. There's an opportunity here that's really being missed in this country, isn't there, to have this conversation that you're talking about?
Absolutely. And it's so unfortunate that most of the mainstream media seems to be going in that direction and rehashing the same old, not just stereotypes, but the practice of, well, this must be somebody's fault out there. You know, the problem lies elsewhere. The problem, of course, lies very much internally because of the kind of society we have that's militarized and the kind of policies that our tax money pays for when we have half of the discretionary funds going to the military. I mean, things happen as a result of those policies, and not all of them are as they are portrayed in the recruiting posters. So, you know, we need to be looking as much internally as anywhere during this period.
And that's the hardest thing in the world to do.
Yeah, you got to face up to some uncomfortable realities sometimes.
Mike, what's going on for Armistice Day from Vets for Peace?
Well, you called it correctly, Armistice Day. Veterans for Peace had a resolution a couple of years ago at a convention where we decided we wanted to return to that name for the day because it has a lot more to do with seeking peace and putting an end to war after the First World War when Armistice Day came about. But some of our members, for example, in Santa Fe, this is the fourth year that they're going to be marching in the Armistice Parade. They'll be speaking at a Vietnam Veterans of America ceremony in the Philadelphia area where this ceremony takes place inside a prison. And Veterans for Peace has a couple of members in a VVA, a Vietnam Veterans of America chapter inside the prison. And there's a chapter in Binghamton, New York. They're going to be in the Armistice Day parade. They're going to be ringing a church bell at 11 a.m. 11 times to mark the day and the hour of the armistice. And Portland, Maine, they've been in the Armistice Day parade since 92, and they're going to have a new banner with them this year that says, VFP is against war, all war, get out of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And other places in Chicago and St. Augustine, Florida, St. Louis, Nashville, and other places around the country, there's a variety of activities that we're engaged in.
So people can go to your website. Again, give us the address of the website.
It's Veterans for Peace, all one word, veteransforpeace.org. And there's a list of chapters around the country and also a list of the activities that some of the chapters are going to be engaged in for Armistice Day.
Mike Ferner, president of Vets for Peace, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
That's Mike Ferner, current president of Veterans for Peace. Kathy Marsham is Vice President of Veterans of Modern Warfare and was also involved in the development of the Army's community-based warrior transition program, first as a company commander and then as an operations officer. The community-based warrior transition program serves ill and injured reserve component soldiers. Kathy Marshman joined me by cell phone and begins with a description of Veterans of Modern Warfare.
Veterans of Modern Warfare is really the newest veteran service organization, and it was kind of born of the need for advocacy for Gulf War veterans in dealing with some of the issues that they had following the Gulf War, particularly health issues surrounding Gulf War syndrome and obtaining VA recognition of their conditions. And Veterans of Modern Warfare has grown now to represent veterans of all branches of service, of all statuses of duty that have served since that Desert Shield, Desert Storm time to the future, to present day.
Talk a little bit about your relationship with the military. You started in 1986 with the Army Reserve.
I spent, you know, 11 years in the reserve as an enlisted member in the reserve. And then I went through my officer training through the officer candidate school. And when I was commissioned in 1997 as a military police officer, I became a platoon leader, still in the Army Reserve. Following a mobilization with my reserve unit to Europe, I came back home and transferred into the Wisconsin National Guard. There I transferred branches from military police to the Quartermaster Corps. In 2004 is when I was asked to get involved with what has become the Warrior Transition Program. At that point in time, it was called the Community-Based Healthcare Organization.
Okay.
It was a brand new program that the Army created in 2004 in response to challenges they were encountering with serving the medical needs of Reserve and National Guard soldiers that had been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we're coming back with medical conditions. The Army's health system was simply overwhelmed by the volume of people that they had to treat at that time. And so they developed this community-based model for providing treatment and services to the Reserve and National Guard soldiers. And so I've been honored to be part of that program since its inception.
Kathy Moshman, that's also what Veterans for Modern Warfare does, isn't it? It helps transition vets and their families how to get their benefits, how to get their advocacy, and so forth.
That is what we work towards, to make sure that veterans are receiving the services that they're entitled to, that they need, to make sure that their families are receiving the services and entitlements that they so much deserve. And so we are working hard to build our national network and to provide more and more advocacy services to veterans and their families. And but in addition to that, we work hard to advocate to Congress and on Capitol Hill to ensure that government agencies are delivering the services that have been promised to veterans and their families.
Kathy, we just heard Department of Veterans Affairs head Eric Shinseki say that they were going to make a concerted effort to end homelessness among vets. There's a lot of organizations that are sprung up just most recently. Do you think that there's enough going on now to have that happen, get the veterans off the street, those that have been forced into homelessness? Do you think there's enough going on at this point?
You know, over the course of the last 8 years, that the conditions of veterans and what they're enduring, the awareness of veterans has been raised, that if we're able to address a lot of these issues at any point in time, it's now, where people are focused on the conditions, either the living conditions or the medical and health conditions of veterans, and that people are willing to do something. It's not as invisible a problem as it has been in the past. So I know I'm encouraged by the Secretary's commitment to improving services to veterans and addressing the issue of homelessness, because we know that that issue is, we know it's out there. We know that there are veterans living on the street, and it's such an injustice. It should just not be that way. And I think that Secretary Shinseki has just shown a commitment to veterans, and I think that personally I have a lot of confidence in the Secretary and what he plans to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly comes from the right background, doesn't he, having served himself, in fact, most recently in Iraq, so that's definitely a huge plus.
I think that, you know, he does. He brings so much to that position, and I think that veterans are going to be well served by Secretary Shinseki.
When you say that the awareness has been raised somewhat, what do you think an incident or a horrible event like the one that just happened at Fort Hood does to raise awareness, and what kind of awareness does it raise?
not necessarily focusing on that tragedy at Fort Hood, but just in general, I think people are hearing more about, certainly about PTSD and traumatic brain injury, and there's both with veterans and those service members coming back are having to deal with. You know, unfortunately, the Fort Hood incident, you know, right now, I guess everybody is struggling to determine what the motive was there, but certainly we hear, again, it's like increased talk about, well, you know, how stressed is our military? And I think when things like this happen, we can't ignore that the military right now is very stressed on this volunteer force. And when folks are asked multiple times to go back in to, you know, multiple deployments, and when the reserve and the National Guard are deployed again and again, I think we're getting to a point where folks are going to have to decide if we're really in this, or if it's time to stop. And then even once we stop fighting the wars, the veterans' issues, service to veterans, doesn't stop. I mean, the service to veterans is ongoing. And so, you know, I can't speak to what awareness it's raising across the country, but I know amongst folks in the business, mm-hmm. shall we say, mm-hmm. The talk is more and more about, well, how long can we sustain this? And the cost is incredible. Mm-hmm. The veterans of today's wars are surviving what in previous wars would have been life-ending injuries. And to survive those injuries and then to receive the treatment and the rehabilitation, following those injuries is not cheap. It costs money. And I think, I'm hoping that the American people will realize that it does cost money to take care of, you know, these American heroes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that Veterans Services is a place where America should be, you know, cheap. We're trying to do things, you know, with as small amount of money as possible,
right.
Because our veterans really deserve everything that this country has to offer.
We're talking with Kathy Marshman, Vice President of Veterans of Modern Warfare. Kathy, talk about now the Warrior Transition Program.
In the Warrior Transition Program, and the unit that I'm with is the Community-Based Warrior Transition Program, which is unique from those Warrior Transition units that they have at the Army installations. In the Community-Based Warrior Transition Unit, those soldiers, after they get back from Afghanistan or Iraq, and if they're injured, we provide the command and control and administrative services for that soldier, and also we coordinate their medical care for them. In the community-based model, these soldiers are Reserve and National Guard soldiers, and they actually, while remaining on active duty orders, return to their home so that they can live at home with their family, surrounded by their friends, in that just normal network of support that an individual has at home, while we, from a distance or remotely, provide medical case management services to ensure that they receive the necessary and appropriate medical care in their community or as close to their home as we can find those services, while still providing that military administrative and command support to those soldiers. It's kind of intended to be a one-stop shop, if you will, where we ensure that the soldier gets not only the medical care and all the administrative services, but there's also connected to other services that may reside in that soldier's community or in that soldier's area, be it government services or services from organizations in their community. In addition, we have professional social workers on our staff that are able to address soldiers' concerns or issues, or the issues for the family. Or if the family has concerns, we'll have spouses that will call and talk with our social worker, and our social worker is either able to address their issues or, again, connect them to something, someone in their community that can assist that family. We pride ourselves in addressing the issues, medical issues, mental health issues, administrative issues for the soldiers and their families, and prepare that soldier for the next step of their life. In some cases, we've got soldiers that in our program that have relatively minor injuries or kind of cut and dry injuries, where it's all they need is one surgery and several weeks of rehab or kind of post-op treatment, and then they have a civilian job that they're ready to go back to, so once they get released from active duty. On the other hand, we've got soldiers that come in that have very high needs, because when we're talking about Reserve and National Guard soldiers, some of these people are maybe small businessmen, or they have their own family business, or they are farmers. They did their military service. They came back. They're injured such that they can't continue to do that business. You know, what do we do now? And a lot of times these soldiers have anxiety because they're concerned about, okay, well, once I get my medical condition addressed and once I'm off active duty, how am I going to support my family? Where am I going to get my livelihood from, because I can no longer run my family farm? I can no longer run my business, or I lost my business while I was deployed. And so we make sure that while those folks are in our program, that we're also connecting them with the services, with training opportunities, so that they can prepare for that next step in life, and it's job retraining or getting connected with vocational rehabilitation services or what have you. Mm-hmm. We like to give just personal service to all of those soldiers that come through our program.
And Kathy, if someone wants to get into the program, can they do it through Veterans of Modern Warfare, or is it another contact?
The Warrior Transition program, that is for Army personnel, and they would work through their home unit. Actually, if there's a Reserve or National Guard soldier that has already deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan and returned home, and they've been released from active duty, but they're sitting at home now and they're saying, I've got a medical problem that wasn't addressed before I was released from active duty. Those individuals should go to their home unit, their home National Guard or Reserve unit, and apply for the program through their home unit. And there is a whole process that the Army has for reviewing those applications to actually bring soldiers back on active duty for the purpose of addressing their medical care.
Oh, that's good to know. Thank you so much for being with us and letting our listeners know how they can serve their own family member better. In order to get in touch with you, people can go through the website, which is
www.vmwusa.org.
Okay, and they can get in touch with you directly there if they want to?
Yes, they can. Oh. We've got links to connect to all of the officers. We are also on Facebook. And so if your listeners are onto Facebook, they can visit our VMW page on Facebook. And we are also on Twitter. Handle on Twitter is @VMWUSA.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Susan.
That was Kathy Marshman, Vice President of Veterans of Modern Warfare and the Army's Community-Based Warrior Program. J.C. Smith speaks to us by phone from Operation Stand Down in Nashville, Tennessee. J.C. Smith plays, among other roles, the Veterans Outreach Coordinator, and he begins by introducing Operation Stand Down.
Well, Operation Stand Down is a nonprofit veterans service agency, and being a nonprofit, you have to wear a lot of hats. I'm also the Veterans Alumni Coordinator and HPRP Grant Coordinator, which is a homeless rehousing homelessness prevention grant that we just got from HUD.
And how did you come up with the name Operation Stand Down?
Well, Operation Stand Down is it's part of veterans or military history. Stand down is when a group of soldiers are ordered to step back from the conflict, move back to a safe place, so to speak.
And in this case, the safe place is you deal with homelessness and veterans.
Yes, that was our initial mission, was to basically help the community reestablish ties with its veterans, homeless veterans being our main goal. And homeless and veterans shouldn't even be in the same sentence, but, you know, it has come to the forefront lately with the homelessness problem in the United States. From that, we've branched off into an employment service, a transitional housing program, and now with the family support unit that the HUD grant stimulus has given us an opportunity to help out some other people as well.
We're going to talk a little more detail about how and who you serve, but I wanted to mention that at the Veterans Affairs National Summit on Ending Homelessness Among Vets, Eric Shinseki most recently said that there were about 131,000 veterans living on the streets at on any given night, and it actually goes up, the number goes up. That's a lot. As you said, homeless and veterans shouldn't really be in the same sentence.
Yes, that's probably a conservative estimate, and the reason being is the homelessness epidemic in the United States is very hard to track, mainly because of the environment that homeless people tend to dwell in. So the numbers are hard to keep up with. Veterans make up about 30% of the homeless population, and about 5% of those homeless veterans are females. They tend to be able to survive in much harsher conditions, so you may not see a lot of veterans walking around on the streets, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that, as you mentioned here, they're very hard to track, what do you think of Shinseki's statement that President Obama and I are personally committed to ending homelessness among veterans within the next 5 years?
I think that's an awesome and a beautiful sentiment. I don't believe it's realistic. As much belief that I have in our United States government and the missions that it has successfully accomplished, I think that one's just a little bit out of reach. We started out with a 10-year mission to end homelessness 7 years ago, and it has been reported that the numbers are down. I just find that kind of hard to believe sometimes.
And apparently the veterans of the Iraq-Afghanistan war are actually going into homelessness a lot faster than we've seen, say, the vets from Vietnam or other war-era vets.
That is exactly true. What used to take about 10 years, now the turnaround time is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 months.
And what do you think that's about?
The recognition of a lot of the co-occurring disorders or issues that happen among homeless veterans in the first place. Most veterans who become homeless, usually it is has something to do with their mental health state. A lot of them have post-traumatic stress. A lot of them also use the mind-altering substances to self-medicate, which leads to addictive behavior and conditions. That's more readily recognized today than it was back in the late mid-70s and before. When the Vietnam era vet came home, they usually they were pretty much known to drink hard and party hard, and most people just kind of wrote them off as, you know, this is a part of war itself.
Mm-hmm. And in your mission, helping the community establish ties with veterans, how does that work to break that that image?
Well, it's not so difficult today. Well, I'm a Vietnam veteran myself, and when I came home, I did not make it well known that I was a veteran. Veterans are viewed in a different light today. I think there is an honor and a virtue of being a U.S. military veteran today. In order to reestablish ties with the community, anyone would have to contribute to that community. And as a contributor, we have to have some assets or something to give back. And what we try to do here at Operation Stand Down is instill in our veterans some work ethic. We try to get them employed. We try to get them on the track of community service. To become more fulfilling in their lifestyle, you know, being a part of a community, they already have established that with their military family. We just try to extend that into the civilian or community family.
Because it's true that veterans, well, not veterans yet, but the people, the young people in the military actually learn quite well to be part of a group and part of a community and function within that very well. It's the transition back to civilian that's so difficult, isn't it?
That's correct. And civilian life is just so much less rigid than military life. And I believe that's part of the transitionary problem, is that in the military, you everything is outlined. And you don't really have a choice as to who you're friend or a foxhole companion is going to be, so you learn to adapt and overcome. In civilian life, it's just an open arena. You can make choices, and a lot of times those are wrong choices. Nobody's making them for you. It's totally up to you. The responsibility and accountability is totally up to you, whereas that's not the case in the military.
We're talking with J.C. Smith of Operation Stand Down in Tennessee. J.C., do you think that the difference between, as you say, you were in Vietnam, but you were more than likely drafted, do you think it makes a difference that the Iraq and Afghanistan vets are volunteers?
Yes, I do. I think that they are a little bit more a part of the mission than we were in the Vietnam era. Now, myself was not drafted. I joined the Army myself, but the majority, of course, were drafted. I think that if a person has a mission to begin with, has a goal, that does instill some personal attachment to what they're doing, and I think mm-hmm. it is very helpful. I think that the soldiers today take a lot more pride and honor in what they do.
Mm-hmm. Which makes it even doubly difficult if they end up on the street within such a short period of getting back to their lives here in the United States.
Yes, I agree. And I think that the transition is much more difficult because, you know, if you have pretty much become a part of that military ideology and their perspective of things, and all of a sudden you are now back in a civilian environment, it is a big adjustment to make. And whereas when a lot of the Vietnam veterans just wanted to get back home, that was their only mission in life. I just need to survive long enough to get back home.
Mm-hmm.
They did more of the self-medicating and those things to deal with the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And is Operation Stand Down in other, is it a network around the country, or is it predominantly headquartered in Nashville?
Well, our Operation Stand Down here is a full-service agency. We're open Monday through Friday, 7:30 to 4. Operation Stand Down around the country can be anything from a one-day event to a three-day event. Some cities have them for 3 days. We have an annual stand-down event still. We just celebrated our 17th annual stand-down event this past October. and it was a great success. We basically served 426 homeless veterans, served them meals, housed them for 3 days, gave them clothes, got them services that we had all in one place, which is a lot of the homeless issue is the fact that you have to go so many different places to get so many different services, and we had it all in one stop.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably 3 or 5 other full-service stand-down agencies in the country.
What else would you like our listeners to know about the organization Operation Stand Down?
One of the main things I always like to convey to other agencies and people who are interested in our community donating time and volunteerism is that 87 cents of every dollar that was donated to Stand Down actually goes toward the client that we serve. That makes us a very efficient agency, of course, but I believe that that efficiency comes from our dedication and commitment to what we do. It's kind of like a car salesman or a salesman. If you are selling something you love, you really don't have to work at it. And we are veterans helping veterans here. So we love what we do, and I think that's why our success is so great and our reputation is so solid today.
And how are you supported?
We're supported through grants and donations. We have multiple grants, everything from United Way, HUD, Department of Labor, then also charitable agencies, volunteers, in-kind donations. We are totally nonprofit.
Do you get anything from Veterans Affairs?
We do share a program with Veterans Affairs. It's what they call a per diem program. In our housing unit, transitional housing program, if a veteran comes through a substance abuse treatment program, the Veterans Affairs will assist us in their overhead, so to speak, for up to 2 years. That usually comes out to about $30 a day.
Hmm. Why don't you give our listeners information how they can contact Operation Stand Down?
I'd be happy to. If you wanted to contact Stand Down, you would call area code 615-248-1981, and we are located at 1125 12th Avenue South, Nashville, Tennessee, 37203. And our website is www.osdnashville.org.
OSDNashville.org.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for being with us, JC. I really appreciate your time. I actually have a family member who served in the military who lives in Nashville, so he's not homeless, but he should definitely know about your organization.
Well, our doors are open to everyone, but we are honored to have a veteran stop by and look around and sometimes just lend a shoulder or an ear to some of the veterans that are having some troubles today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That was J.C. Smith from Operation Stand Down, osdnashville.org, or 615-248-1981.
My best friend's overseas in the desert where it's dry, fighting for our country, and I need a reason why. I remember when he was a younger man. Now he's a soldier fighting in a foreign land. Now we're older. God bring him home again.
In our last segment today, Jim Lomason of Seattle, a photographer and author of a not yet published book, Exit Wounds, Life After War, Soldier Stories. As I say, Jim Lomason is not a veteran, and I asked him what brought him to write this book.
Well, Susan, there were several reasons. One reason was my father was a World War II veteran, and I grew up hearing his stories of his time at the Battle of the Bulge. And his stories were a lot like my fellow kids in the 50s and 60s. Fathers told stories of the war, and it was much like the newsreels that we'd seen on TV. And I didn't realize until much later in his life how much he was affected by his experience at war. And It wasn't until he was in his 80s and a couple years before his death that he started to tell me the real stories about his experience in World War II, and they were so much different from what the kind of heroic picture that I got when I was a kid that I realized that he had been keeping this inside him his entire life. And so, you know, his generation was told basically to man up, go out, forget that anything ever happened, buy a house, and live the dream of the 50s and 60s. And so they never really dealt with the issues. And so as we would go for walks, he would tell me new stories, and they were so different. I realized that he had been keeping these secrets for 60 years, and it had profoundly affected him. He was a great father, loving father, but now that I've interviewed so many other soldiers, I can really see characteristics that he had that are similar to what today's soldiers are experiencing. And so that was one of the reasons that I felt that we need to hear the stories of the soldiers, and they need to tell the stories, because keeping them inside is an unhealthy thing.
You're right. And again, this man up, I think these days we call it suck it up, mm-hmm. is a way to submerge these stories. And as long as they're submerged, we're going to continue having wars.
Right.
What are the most profound stories that that you collected?
Well, you know, as I approached this project, I knew that this wasn't my story, and it wasn't a project that was meant to perpetuate any particular political position. I felt that all the soldiers needed to tell their stories, regardless whether they were pro-mission, anti-war, or wherever they were on the political spectrum. And those are the stories that the public needs to hear. And so, you know, one soldier, and he didn't say this to me, he said this to his mother, but he was a twice-deployed Marine, and he came back with severe PTSD, and he wouldn't talk. And finally, after his mother massaged him and tried to get him to talk, he blurted out, "Mom, I wouldn't wish war on my worst enemy." And to me, that is probably one of the most succinct statements about war that I've ever heard, because if you wouldn't wish war on your worst enemy, who would you wish war on? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that combined with soldiers who have told me of things that they've experienced and things that they've done, you know, that is now profoundly imprinted on their souls. And, you know, they have to deal with that for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Jim Lumison, your book, Exit Wounds, Life After War, Soldier Stories, is not out yet. Talk a little bit about one of the people you interviewed here, Ash.
Ash Wolfson was a kid from the Midwest. He lived on a commune, and he joined the National Guard so he could get a college education. He wanted to teach ceramics and photography in college, and he was told he would never go to war. He ended up in Iraq, and he was profoundly affected by an experience he had, and that was a convoy ran over a two-year-old girl, Iraqi girl, and a goat. And he wasn't in that particular convoy, but his involvement was finally to realize that American government gave reparations to the family of the child, and they gave the family $600 for the goat because the goat was an income stream, and they gave the family $200 for their child that was killed. Mm. And Ash was profoundly affected by that. He had, at that time, he had a two-year-old daughter back at home, and so that's something that, even though he didn't take part in that, that affected him profoundly. Mm. One thing about PTSD is that it is the human response to war. It's not an unnatural thing. And so when soldiers come back, they do have to deal with what they've seen, what they've committed. And one of the things I wanted to do in this project is to interview soldiers of all political beliefs. And, you know, it wasn't my mission to cherry pick or pick the worst stories or the best stories. I wanted to convey all of the stories. And so I've interviewed soldiers who believe in what they did, and I want those words in this book, as well as the soldiers who made a 180-degree turn in their belief systems. Soldiers who joined one of the branches of the military after 9/11 and then had their experiences at war. And when they came back, sometimes they didn't realize until 6 months after they had returned what they had been doing. But by seeing that evolution from joining after 9/11 and then becoming a complete anti-war activist is quite an amazing transformation. You know, I don't think most of us are ready to admit minor traffic violations, you know. And here's soldiers who have experienced something and now believe the total opposite of what they believed when they went into the military.
Okay.
And, you know, I'd also like to say, you know, this project is a book project. It's also a traveling exhibition. And as I interviewed soldiers, they, from time to time, showed me pictures. And so partway through this project, I started to ask soldiers to give me photographs. And now I've collected over 2,000 pictures that the soldiers took while in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the pictures are amazing. And they vary from battle scenes to ruins to sunsets to Iraqi children in school, almost frat-like parties at the base, and portraits and pictures of soldiers dressed up at like Santa Claus at Christmas. And so these pictures are an amazing document of life at war, and they're really, in a lot of ways, cinematic. And so the exhibitions that I've mounted include maybe 20 or 30 pictures that I've taken of the soldiers after the return from war. But it also includes the 2,000 pictures that the soldiers took, and they're all mounted in a kind of a cloud or a grid of images. And it's a pretty amazing experience to walk through and see what a soldier who's facing possibly death might take a picture of alongside of the soldiers back in the States after their experience at war. Also included in this cloud of photographs are excerpts from their interviews. And so as you move through the exhibition, you can choose what to look at. But it's a pretty organic experience, and it's very powerful.
Thank you for doing all of that work, Jim Lomason. This is important stuff.
Well, I think, you know, Veterans Day is a day that we should all recognize. And I do think that there has been a lot of misinformation put out about the soldiers. And I think one of the important things that we have to remember is that we can't confuse the war with the warrior. And the soldiers that we send have been kind of dismissed by both the left and the right. The right has used the soldiers as kind of cardboard cutouts, and they've positioned the support your troops, and we can't talk about the merits of the war because the soldiers are there and we don't want to undermine the soldiers. And so the soldiers have been used as kind of a cardboard cutout to deflect a conversation that I believe we should have every second that we send people to war, because the effects on the soldiers is profound. Every soldier that we send to war is essentially a casualty of war. And so we need to ask those questions continually. And I also think the left has been rather dismissive of the soldiers. Sometimes I believe feel like the soldiers knew what they were getting into. They joined for whatever reasons, and we really need to appreciate how smart, how well-meaning, how good intention the soldiers are.
This whole question of the soldiers know what they're getting into makes me really, really laugh with a bitter chuckle, because how many Americans know what not only what we were getting into, but what we are in?
Absolutely.
Very few Americans are paying attention to that, and
yeah.
It's much easier to scapegoat the soldiers.
Yeah. And there is a a photograph taken in Iraq where somebody wrote something like, America is not at war. The Marines are at war. America is at the mall.
That's right.
And so, you know, we have been told to basically ignore the soldiers and ignore the war. You know, during World War II, 100% of Americans knew a soldier in combat. During the Vietnam War, almost all Americans knew soldiers in combat. But during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, it's maybe 2 or 3% of Americans who actually know a soldier in combat. So we don't know the soldiers, and so we don't know who we're sending to war. And so that separates us from the reality of what we're doing.
Learn more about Jim Lomason's work at his blog, exitwoundscominghome.blogspot.com. exitwoundscominghome.blogspot.com. And that's our show for this week. Remember our veterans on November 11th and reach out and shake a vet's hand, look into his or her face, and listen deeply to the story you hear. As usual, all views and opinions are those of the host and guests and not Stanford University or KZSU. Visit our website to download any of our other shows at RaisingSandRadio.org or contact me at Susan@RaisingSandRadio.org. Now I'll have a change of pace and we'll go out with Griffin House and I Remember It's Happening Again.
My grandpa fought in World War II, my uncle fought in Nam. My father was too young, he went to school and met my mom. And her dad always told us stories around dinner time. And there's one he told when I was young that sticks out in my mind. He said 10 years after daddy taught me about the birds and bees, I was stranded in Pearl Harbor fighting off the Japanese. When the kamikaze pilots came and dove in without warning, I was on the Arizona on a warm December morning. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older and it's happening. Hard to have forgiveness for the things they did that day. And our president decided we should make their people pay. So we dropped on Nagasaki and we cut them down to size. And the one we dropped on Hiroshima left them vaporized. And I heard some Christians saying, what would Jesus do? What if you were on the wrong side? Would he point the gun at you? And they read through every word of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, so they could see if killing was the side that Christ was on. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in